is a radical organizer and parent who lives here in the East Bay and who's done extensive research on legal issues around parenting, children, dependence, and incarceration or arrest, especially in times of grand juries. Mickey is a radical psychologist and organizer, also from the East Bay, who specializes in PTSD and trauma care and treatment. So Mona's going to start things off.
Hi. Thanks for sticking around. I know this is a long day. I'm a little nervous, and I'm not feeling very prepared. I'm sick, so I'll do my best. But what I want to talk about, I think, is pretty grossly overlooked in our communities, and that's dependent care. It's not something that is really deemed important or necessary. In fact, I think it's really insidious the way that it's neglected in capitalist culture and society. And I'm really nervous. Damn, this is hard. I also haven't done this before. let's see. Maybe I'll start with this. I have this handout. I'm going to pass it around. It kind of goes over. Wow, I'm shaking. Okay. When we look at like things that could cause somebody to decide to go up and speak to a grand jury, having dependents and not having anybody to look for them is an absolutely understandable, I think, reason why somebody might decide to go and speak to a grand jury. Something to avoid that is not shaming the parent for being in the movement, not giving unsolicited parenting advice, particularly if you're not a parent, which are all things that happen. Calling people breeders is not useful. Children and their care providers are some of the most marginalized people in our movements. And that's furthered by people in our movements. And so ways to avoid that are to set up ways of supporting those people so that things don't happen, such as them going and speaking to a grand jury. Or another flip side that often happens is people not ever taking the time to understand the struggles of the parents in the movement or to get to know their kids. And then when the parents get arrested, calling up every single person that they can think of, maybe family members, and just kind of trying to figure out what to do when the emergency's already happened, which is taking away agency from the parents. It's endangering the children, and is an absolute no-no, and the way it can be avoided is simply approaching the people in the movement that have kids and asking them what they need. And it seems really simple, but it seems really hard also for people. Like, I see people kind of backing away from kids. I have theories about that. I think that some people are really triggered by kids. I think that through our ancestry and colonization, we all have been hurt and wounded, and it's through our childhood that we like sort of learn about the world and like learn how much we are oppressed. And some of us don't want to reface that. And being around people's kids absolutely puts that in your face, and you can't avoid it. And so I want to encourage people to think about the people in their lives that have kids and think about their own experiences as children and think about what they needed and what they lacked when they were growing up. And don't be afraid to approach parents and ask them what their experiences are like and what would make their experiences easier. And do this before an emergency happens. Do this before parents are being subpoenaed to grand juries, before somebody in the movement gets arrested. Do this now. Reach out to people. Find out what they're doing. I think most parents probably have thought about their kids. I don't think very many parents are going to just unwittingly enter these movements and endanger their children. And so if you're curious or concerned about that, you can become part of their support network, which is great, because we all need support whether we have kids or not. So I have this handout, and on one side it has an example of a power of attorney. And a power of attorney is one of the easiest ways to legally have kids taken care of when their parents are absent without having to go through the court system. It has to be notarized in order to, like, for sure stand up. You can write a note, but it's better to have it notarized and have the proper language because judges like the fancy rhetoric and stuff. So I have an example of that. And one thing about a power of attorney, you can find a person, it's usually best if you only have one person, and it varies. I mean, there's so many variations of different legal ways of having children and dependents supported when their care providers are gone. And there's way too numerous to get into. But with the power of attorney, if you have multiple people that have custody of a child, they have to come to some kind of agreement about who that person would be and discuss it. And the person who they're naming needs to be aware that they're being named, obviously, and be willing. And it's best, especially if it were to come to court, the children should be emotionally comfortable and bonded with this person. Because if a family member, say, gets you know, word that the parents are incarcerated and decides to try to take custody, the only way that the person with power of attorney is going to win is if they can prove that they have a bond to this child and that this child or children is comfortable and safe with them. So that's what a power of attorney is good for. The only drawback with the power of attorney is that if you're not legally, if you're not a relative of the children, you can't apply for any kind of state assistance like food stamps or anything like that. You need a family member for that. One way to avoid that is find a family member who you trust, who doesn't necessarily want to raise your children, but is willing to have power of attorney to be able to apply for those things. And then have the person that you trust with your kids take care of the like school, medical, any kind of legal decision making. Sometimes it's ideal to like figure out a way to keep kids in their home. So there's other things you can do. The larger your community is and the larger amount of people that like care for your kids, that your kids trust, the better. And the way that that can play out is you have your power of attorney who makes all the legal decisions or has the like agency to make those legal decisions. But you have all these different people, and then you coordinate care. And a good way to coordinate care is have a list of all the different things that people are willing to do. So if you're willing to support people, these parents, go to them, tell them what you can provide, and then they have your contact information. I have a website called Care Calendar that's on here on this reference. Maybe I should pass this out since I've been talking about it. Some of the resources are Care Calendar, which I just talked about. There's the Incarcerated Parents Manual, which will go into all the various different forms and ways that you can support kids or take care of kids, all the legality stuff. And then they also have the part that's about like what happens to your benefits if you have any kind of like Social Security, food stamps, any of that kind of stuff. Trying to find ways to cohesively support each other is really important, and not reacting, I guess, also making it clear that when we react to situations out of our own fear, we take agency away from people. So, I mean, and this isn't just with like kids. This is like, it's really important to really think about what you're doing in these situations and like really stop and just pause, breathe, and figure out what the next best step is. And I think talking to people is really smart, but not bringing in extra people, not doing a bunch of like extra things. Like if parents are arrested, don't call every single family member they have. Your intentions might be good, but ultimately it can unwittingly hurt the situation. I kind of feel like I'm done. Thank you.
Okay, so my name is Mickey. I'm a clinical psychologist. I actually prefer like the term radical psychologist, like that, or maybe anarcho-psychologist, I don't know. So I'm going to talk about trauma, PTSD, and the healing process, and I'd like to do so by framing it in both a political and existential context. But before I do, there's two questions that were posed to me that I think are important to address very briefly and that maybe you could all hold in mind as I move through this. The first question is, should people with mental health issues be involved in organizing? My immediate response to that, well, who the fuck doesn't have a mental health issue? Most of us have had, will have, or do have a mental health issue that we'll contend with at some point in our life. To me, the question is, it's not so much whether or not one has a mental health issue, but are they taking care of themselves to the extent and also receiving the social and communal support that it doesn't compromise their work or their movement. The other question that was posed to me, and a woman earlier actually asked this, should we discourage disclosure of mental health issues to prevent them from being used as a weapon against us, say by the cops or for incarcerated? My answer is no, because to discourage disclosure is to keep something like this inside and in secret. And doing so is an act of repression, both in the psychoanalytical sense of the term and in the political sense of the term, and can potentially do more damage than any good that can come out of it. So I want to emphasize that trauma arises out of the dominant forms of oppression and systems of violence that we're all organizing against. For instance, I think, well, I'd like to think that many of us will agree that patriarchy is traumatizing, right? So I think we must have a movement that is explicitly anti-racist and explicitly feminist in order for it to be conducive to the psychological and emotional well-being of its participants. Otherwise, it's going to contribute to and or exacerbate trauma that is reflective in patriarchal systems. It's for this very reason that I think we need to be cognizant of how our individual and collective actions in the movement can be traumatizing to others. So, as I move into what constitutes PTSD, I want to depathologize it and I want to demystify what it is. First, exposure to a traumatic event does not mean that one has or will eventually develop PTSD. It's not a cause and effect experience in which a traumatic experience acts on a passive subject. When symptoms do arise, they usually happen shortly after an adverse life event, but may not develop until months or even years later, if at all. And the symptoms, as well as our attempts to manage the symptoms, may disrupt our ability to achieve a desired quality of life. But to depathologize this process, we want to normalize psychological and physical reactions to trauma as a means to protect oneself from the internal and external reminders of that event. So I'm not going to go too much in detail into what constitutes PTSD, but I'll very briefly talk about the four main symptoms, and then if you have questions, you can ask me more in detail later. But there's four symptoms, main symptoms to PTSD: intrusion, avoidance, constriction, and hyperarousal. Intrusive symptoms are those symptoms in which one is persistently kind of re-experiencing the event, okay? And they can include dissociative reactions such as flashbacks. Symptoms of avoidance is like persistent avoidance of internal and external stimuli that arouse recollections of the traumatic event, such as avoiding thoughts, emotions, people, places, and events that can remind one of the event. Constrictive symptoms are feeling numb or detached or disconnected from self, others, and the world. And then hyperarousal is a state of permanent alert or hypervigilance, as if the danger might return at any moment. Some important common emotional reactions to consider are feeling hopeless about the future, a loss of interest in meaningful activities, a loss of intimacy, or feelings of abandonment. And that's a key factor here, is there's this profound sense of abandonment, which increases a sense of isolation and alienation, not only from one's personhood, but from the world around them. Depression and suicidal thoughts, anxiety and panic attacks, and alcohol and drug abuse are all common comorbid diagnoses. And it makes sense that these would co-occur. A lot of the physical reactions to trauma mirror panic attacks. And one way people tend to deal with this is through self-medicating. or to avoid these symptoms or to numb them out through alcohol and drug abuse. So that's a very common reaction. Now, like I said, I want to normalize the psychological and physical reactions to PTSD as a means to protect oneself. So in doing so, it's important to validate the ways in which reaction to trauma and symptoms of PTSD unfold. We want to validate the desire to avoid reminders of the traumatic event. Similarly, when one is faced with a real or imagined threat of annihilation, as PTSD often manifests, living in more constricted, narrow ways, or feeling the need to be constantly on guard or alert as a means to create a sense of safety, security, and sanity, that's called for. That makes sense. And so we want to validate the desire to be free of symptoms through a magical or sudden cure, in which one does not have to face up to the injustice, to the atrocity, and to the absurdity of it all. But we also want to demystify the notion that avoidance or false securities can bring about relief from suffering. Rather, it's important to shed light on the ways, on how such ways of coping actually maintain one's suffering. And so what I do, I like to refer to these as maintenance coping skills, such as self-medication and avoidance. They bring about a temporary relief from the symptoms and a temporary relief from the pain and suffering, but they only mask and cover up the symptoms. And when we're not drinking, or we find ourselves in a moment when we're not avoiding, those symptoms are still right there. That pain and suffering is still right there. So paradoxically, they serve to actually enhance and intensify the very symptoms from which we're trying to escape. I think a lot of us in this room understand the value of struggle and bringing about liberation from oppressive circumstances and conditions. So I think PTSD can be looked at in a very similar way by emphasizing the necessity of engaging in our own struggle rather than avoiding it in order to bring about liberation from our own pain and suffering. So I want to also emphasize that traumatic events have a tendency to jolt us out of a world we thought to be safe and secure, and they expose us to our vulnerabilities and to our limitations, and they force us to face up to the fragility of life. And not only are we forced to question the world as we know it, but we're tasked with this very difficult challenge of making sense out of the imbalance between the world we once knew and the reality with which we're currently being confronted. So what makes something traumatic is not actually the traumatic event in and of itself, but it's the destruction of significance and meaning that accompanies trauma. Thus, a necessary part of the healing process is a reworking of this significance, in which it's possible to transcend suffering by making meaning out of it and discovering new possibilities within our current limitations. And this is where I like to pull from Viktor Frankl, if any of you are familiar with him. He was a dissenter, psychoanalyst, dissenter of Freud's, and survived Auschwitz. And he argues that although we may not choose the conditions into which we're thrown, even under the most oppressive circumstances, we still have a choice. Although those choices may be limited by social power structures, we still have a choice in how we relate and respond to those oppressive conditions. And according to Frankl, the discovery or construction of meaning can help one overcome and transcend even the most adverse of life events. And he proposed that this comes about by the attitude we choose to take towards suffering. Although we can't change the fact that a traumatic event occurred, we can choose our attitude toward it in such a way that it facilitates rediscovering a meaning, purpose, and hope. And doing so not only mitigates against the development of PTSD and other forms of psychological distress, but in this way can be seen as a challenge to overcome rather than a disorder, a disease, or an illness to be feared or avoided. So there's also some positive that could come out of this too. Trauma calls us to an awareness of how strong we can be in an authentic sense, that in spite of it all, we're still here and we're still alive. And so resiliency manifests itself as we continue to move one foot in front of the other, as we re-engage in our lives. So as we look at the healing process, I want to talk about how self-care is not an act of self-indulgence. It's a necessary part of any movement. If one doesn't regularly attend to his or her physical and psychological well-being, his or her efforts and contributions to the movement can be compromised, as I mentioned a little bit earlier. And our willingness to care for ourselves either individually or collectively helps mitigate and protects us from potentially traumatic experiences and may provide a level of resiliency that has the potential to prevent the development of PTSD. But self-care should not be viewed solely as an individual process, but a social and communal one. So when we're talking about making meaning out of our experiences, meaning making is not an individual affair, but a social one. Meaning is co-constructed in a shared world with shared values. And our larger web of meaning shape how we experience, act, think, behave, and so forth. And so a trauma to an individual is a trauma to all of us. Disassociation is not an individual process, but a social one. There are cultural nettings for overwhelming life experiences that could be supportive or dismissive. And when these cultural nettings are dismissive, such as commonly found in capitalism, they contribute to a disassociative process. For instance, standards of care, especially mental health, look at how they often encourage disassociation in the name of coping, management, and surviving. So we're really not resolving some of the issues that we're being confronted with. We're not moving through a healing process. We're merely managing these symptoms in the ways that they conflict with productive functioning in the workforce, at home, school, and so forth. Or even look at the machismo that's reflected in even some of our own circles, in which there's this misogynistic social narrative around strength and weakness in terms of how one is expected to face up to psychological or emotional distress, such as we must be hard and strong and repress our emotions rather than appear weak to others. When doing so, we further engage in such narratives. Not only do we deny our own humanity, we further contribute to the dissociative and isolating process. So, is anybody familiar with Judith Herman's work, Trauma and Recovery? It's a phenomenal book that situates trauma in the political context. And so I'm pulling from some of her work here. When engaging in social support and collective care, we want to facilitate the rebuilding or reestablishing of connection to self, others in the world. We want to help the individual or the community reestablish a sense of trust and safety. Increase that sense of autonomy and control and self-respect. Help the person or the community rebuild a positive self-view, which requires tolerance for the survivor's fluctuating need for distance and closeness. Supportive responses to traumatic experiences and PTSD can detoxify one's sense of shame, stigma, and defilement. But the hardest and most important work in providing support in the therapeutic process of another, or is the therapeutic presence of another, the hardest and most important work is a being there and a staying with and a bearing witness to one's suffering. So bearing witness and staying with one's suffering helps mitigate against the loneliness and isolation, which is probably the most carcinogenic factor in PTSD. It helps move on from grief to mourning. It invites agency to tell the story and invites choice. Taking a place of neither retreat nor imposition, it resituates the other. And the trust and relaxation built out of attunement unfolds possibilities within limitations. So the radical acceptance and normalization hails a central protest of all traumatic experience, which is, I can't believe this happened to me. Why me? So in this process, and this is the last thing I'll say, but in this process, as Judith Herman argues, the survivor seeks not absolution, but fairness, compassion, and willingness to share his or her suffering. So again, the most important factor in helping one move through the process of facing up to the absurdity of it all is to be able to sit with them. It's not what we say or do in these matters. It's just it's a matter of being present, present with. So that's it.